I'm Carrington Clark.
And I'm Alan Kohler.
In 2026, business big and small is moving at a rapid pace. And ABC Business Daily is here to help you cut through the noise and spin. Monday to Thursday.
And on Friday, I sit down with business leaders, founders, creators, change makers, and those in the know to ask them how they see the world, because that's business.
All in the ABC Business Daily feed on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Vinko Anthony grew up on the shores of the Adriatic Sea, and he spent a lot of his childhood with his nonna. The two of them would spend hours walking together, hand in hand, in silence, listening to the birds, the waves, and to the wind. And when they got home and sat down to eat, Vinko and his nonna would listen to each other. Vinko took these lessons in listening and love very seriously. He brought them with him when his family migrated to Australia and into his vocation as a matchmaker. When Vinko finally got the courage to tell the love of his life, a secret that he had been hiding for 5 years, he just had to trust that all that love and listening would come back to him. Vinko has written a book about what he's learned from his life as a matchmaker. It's called All In, How to Make Love Stick. Hi, Vinko.
Hi, Sarah.
Where in Croatia did you grow up?
In Dubrovnik, in the province of Dubrovnik, on a peninsula called Pelješac, a small area called Kuna, and on an island of Šipan, where my grandmother was, my nonna.
So what does that part of the world look like?
Sarah, the childhood was really surrounded by this, it's the world of simplicity and beauty at the same time. It's the world where it's carefree and calm, and particularly in the 70s, there was, you know, it was communism and then Yugoslavia, so you really just had your environment and your evenings would be spent running around the neighborhood talking to your neighbors and elderly and listening to their stories, or shared beautiful long lunches and dinners with your family.
Who were some of the locals that you enjoyed speaking to?
I was always an old soul, and I don't know whether it was that little gay boy in the making in me that felt more secure within elderly crowd than my own peers, because maybe I was too scared to be picked on or so forth. But the elderly architect, I remember him very vividly. His name was Josip, who would go into Germany and come back with all these. He taught me the form of art and a sort of discipline very early on. And then there was a woman who had the most beautiful gardens, and, you know, and the little gay in me loved all the flowers. So I would spend a lot of time with her. And we had a lot of visitors from all over the world that would even that early on immigrated into other parts of the world. And during summer times, everyone would come back. And it was where everyone would gather together around the square and have these like long evenings. And my call was to come home when the street lights come on for dinner. And it was that free and wonderful. I always felt heard, and I always felt seen, and I always felt loved. I was very lucky that I was surrounded in this very safe environment, particularly growing up in that time as a gay man.
What about things at home, Vinko? What do you remember that environment being like at your family house?
Home, there was two different homes. There was home with my mum and my father and my siblings, and then there was the nonna's house. The mother father traditional home wasn't really happy. I know my parents didn't really have a happy marriage, I don't think. So when that fell apart when we came to Australia in a bigger community and that weren't surrounded by small environments, I wasn't surprised, to be honest. Where when I would go to spend time with my grandma, that part of it was really just this wonderful times together that, you know, I think she was my kind of quiet force and still continues to be. We had this unspoken understanding.
What did she look like, Vinco?
Oh, that again, that sort of, she had very different characters. She was this one woman that you would see when she would go into the fields with a scarf on her head, and she would carry a whole big sack of food for animals on top of her head on the way back in her little flower-printed dress that she had for the fields. They were, you know, I remember vividly the wardrobe was the outfit for the funerals, the outfit for the city, the outfit for the weddings. And
the fields.
And the fields. The fields were down in the magazine. And she, whatever she put on, whatever character she played, she was this fierce, powerful woman that just owned it. I think her husband for that stage and age died. She was in the, I think, late 50s, early 60s when he passed. So she had to hold it all. And she adapted this personalities for different parts of her life. I never remember my grandmother, doesn't matter what she did for the day, she would come home from the fields or from the city, and she would always cook a meal for herself, but she always had napery set up and all the crockery and the table was set. She would go and change for lunch and come sit down and enjoy that part of the life.
Even when she was by herself?
Even when she was on her own. It was incredible.
And when the two of you were there together at her home, how would you spend your time? What do you remember?
There was a lot of come and help me with chores. As loving and as nurturing she was also this fierce force of nature that things had to be done. So from very, very early young age, I knew how to iron, I knew how to chop wood, I knew how to go into the fields. It was work. But our private times, the comfortable silences were really wonderful, and that's what I remember. And there were little sort of secret lessons along the way that she sort of took me under her wing, I think, from all the other grandchildren, because I was kind of an old soul and a nurturer always. She loved that I would, you know, massage her hands, or that I would prepare the table for her to sit down. The little things that I don't think she ever had, because she went through World War II and then had her children, and it was survival.
What about school for you? What are your memories of what school was like in Croatia?
School was amazing for me, but the only problem was that my mom was one of my teachers.
Oh, really?
Yes. So she was part of the school, and she was a teacher of languages. And if I have one thing that I regret in life is that I didn't speak different language every 3 or 4 months to my mom's suggestion. And now if I could change one thing or perfect one thing, it would be to speak so many languages differently. So the school was, I was very disciplined at school because she was.
Was she strict?
She was strict, especially with me, and I would never get dot marks with her. I was always a really good student, and but it was also a boys' club, even in Croatia, Yugoslavia. Then you still had the soccer club and you had your teammates and you would play that. But I was that kid that was never that great at soccer and would take his knittings to the practice, and because they never let me play.
How was that? How did the other kids receive that? You sitting in the stands knitting.
Well, it was better than my mother's red boots and grandmother's bras walking around the city, I think. But
tell me more, Vinco. When did that happen?
Well, I had this wonderful relationship with my mother's red boots. She had this pair of red boots that she got from Germany or somewhere, and she would go to school. At some stage, I would be in the afternoon school, and she'd be there in the morning. The minute she would leave, the music, Bonnie M or ABBA would come on the record player, and I would put on the boots and parade up and down. And my godmother caught me walking up and down the stairs with these, like, shawls and scarves and mum's boots. And, oh, my God.
But there's this interesting tradition of carnivals in your part of Croatia, and I guess that was a time that you got to be extravagant and flamboyant and it be celebrated. Tell me about carnival time.
Carnival time was a really special time for me. It was a sense of freedom. I would put on a mask, or whether it was makeup or a wig or a dress or high heels, and I was able to be this person that who underneath you don't understand what it is then. You just thought you wanted to go to a carnival as a girl. That's what I wanted to be presented as. But, you know, it's like Venice Carnival in Croatia. Sort of the whole of February is everyone parades around the streets and everyone dresses up and you go door knocking and you show off your outfits. And, of course, everybody knew it was Vinko underneath that bad makeup and things. But I didn't think that nobody knew. I just went, and I was so proud of myself.
And what's the celebration? What's it in honour of?
The carnivals are there just, it's an old tradition where you celebrate the freedom of new beginnings and ending of winters and beginnings of summers. And it still continues.
What about noticing other boys when you were young, Vinko? When you look back, how were you seeing, you know, classmates at school maybe differently? How do you remember that?
I have talked about this with friends, and I've talked about it with family and with myself. I've tracked back down to, I think, 4 years old, that I knew that I was looking at, you know, my sister's or my mother's friends. You know, it was the 70s in Croatia. There was, you know, Speedo heaven. And, you know, I would look at men's legs, hairy legs, and I think I was like looking at them as, I want legs like that, but I think it was more like, no, they're good legs. Whether that happened at 4 or 6 or very early on, I always had a very, very affectionate relationship with men, but I always had friendships with women and older women because I think that's felt safe.
For a lot of men of your generation, there was a sense of shame that came along with that awareness. Was that part of the mix for you? Or?
Not so much for me. I don't think there was shame at that age. I think the shame came in my teenage years, where you actually realized what it was. But during childhood, I really celebrated my effeminate side, and it didn't. I was very lucky. I was surrounded with a lot of love.
Before you left Croatia, you did have a conversation with a cousin who was visiting for summer. Tell me about that.
Well, it was. Oh, that's such a lovely part of my acknowledgement of being gay. I was on the pier by the water, fishing or just throwing rocks in the sea. And you know, I mean, I came to Australia when I was 12, 13, so it would have been before that time. And there was a cousin who lived in Germany that asked me about whether I had a girlfriend. And I, just even as a kid that young, I was comfortable enough to say, no, I don't think I like girls or something like that. And I think it was, again, unspoken, comfortable silences between us, and he accepted and acknowledged that it's okay, that not everybody has to like girls. It was a lovely moment.
In 1980, the president of the former Yugoslavia, Josip Tito, died. What did that mean for your family?
Well, it meant Australia. My father grew up in Australia, and and he was Australian, and so it was that, as far as I recall, the decision was made very quickly that the life for us was going to be better in Australia, because there felt that what happened later with the war was going to happen. So it was an automatic crazy change.
How did you feel about making that move as a young teenager to the other side of the world?
I was so excited, Sarah. I loved Dubrovnik. I loved Šipan. I loved Kunajn. I loved my childhood. I was always acknowledged as somebody who was quite patriotic around his kind of world, even as a kid. But you had these promises of you coming to a country of opportunity, and Australia was so wrapped up for us that I, you know, it was the first time, of course, on a big plane and leaving and having this whole new life, but I had no idea what was waiting here for me.
What kind of contrast were the western suburbs of Melbourne to what you were used to?
It's a big part of who I am today, and I wouldn't change it. It gave me this resilience, I think, in life. But I wouldn't want that on anyone. It was the expectations of what Australia offered and the differences. Like, we would never leave home in Croatia unless we were dressed, and, you know, you wouldn't even eat on the street. It was rude. There was some strict rules from Nonna to my parents to everyone in kind of how you live, how you were seen from others. And you were always well presented and so forth. And my first impression of Australia was, first of all, the space and the surroundings. We landed over Sydney and I saw the beautiful opera house and the bridge and so forth. And we stopped over. And then I went, oh, this is amazing. And then we flew, you know, into Melbourne, and it was then, early 80s, was deserted red earth that I had any connection to. And then we drove back into the western suburbs where my father had this tiny little flat compared to a beautiful old house that we grew up in the medieval town and surrounded by beautiful nature in Croatia. And I remember putting on a little, it was the 80s, so I had a little, to go to Australia, I had a little leather tie and painted shoes and an outfit. So I put on that outfit to go for a walk through.
With De Love Will Cry, Vinko.
Oh,
very poignant.
It was really quiet.
And what happened when you set out in your little leather tie and
painted
shoes?
So off I went into the western suburbs of St Albans in Melbourne. And the first image that I remember, and this is not being derogative towards anybody in any way, but this stuck in my mind so much. There was a woman in a pink tracksuit with moccasins, you know, those agbuti kind of moccasins, eating hot chips, walking out of a Kentucky Fried Chicken, and I could smell the smell of food on the street. And then I looked at her, and I looked at me, and I went, then that was, I think I made a decision then and there that I had to do something to get out.
And what did that look like? What did you do?
Well, it was a slow process of kind of settling and going into school first. But I really literally, not long, first of all, of course, I locked myself into learning English, and there was 6 months of ESL classes at school, and my education was much higher than the general kids my age in Australia. So I went from, instead of year 8, I went into year 10. So I was with much older kids. So that 6 months of studying English kind of paid off, and then I could go into normal classes. And that's, I remember taking myself into town and going, there must be more to this country. You know, the survival wasn't about fitting in. The survival was about figuring out the people and the tone and the voice that I was going to have and what I was going to achieve of my life here. I remember having those thoughts very early on. And so I went into the city, and I went into Satyara, and I walked around, and I kind of went, okay, well, I know where I need to be. And then I got myself five jobs while I was still at school.
Doing what sort of work?
from babysitting to cooking, cleaning windows in shops, vacuuming stores, paper rounds, all sorts of little bits and pieces of jobs, and which all led to other jobs because I was so joyful, I think, in my work that you know, some merchandising work would come. So there was all this work coming
and
in.
Were you saving money? Or
it was all going aside for my exit plan to get out of Western suburbs.
And so how old were you when you moved out of home?
I think 16.
And had you finished high school?
I finished high school and I went to... Then you could register... You could go to Adelaide on the bus and open a bank account in Adelaide.
In Adelaide?
Yes, because they gave you a license at the age of 16. So I heard that from someone. So I went on a bus to Adelaide to open a bank account so that when I was 16, I could go and get my license. And I was the only kid at school with a car and a license. I had enough to save to buy a car. I had a little Datsun 200B, I remember, green. And I had this exit plan from there that everything was saved, everything was planned, and I moved out with a friend.
A few years later, Vinko, you moved further afield to London. What kind of place was London for a young gay man coming out?
I think a big reason of moving to London was to have the whole coming out in an easier way. I think I didn't have the pressures of family. I've always heard wonderful things of, you know, being anyone that I knew that visited said, I would love it. And I was like a kid in a chocolate factory in London, and that opened so many doors.
Are there any memories that you can share on a family-friendly radio station?
Yes, there's a lot of memories. I embraced London, and the work ethic that my grandmother, my nonna, taught me, I think carried me through my whole life. So in London, I was again having two or three different jobs, and I knew the environments where I was going to start working, and I started working in the theatres as a Royal Room host. And
What does that mean?
That means you look after celebrities and royalty when they come in to see a show. And I worked on a play called Madea with Diana Rigg. And I was totally obsessed with her and the story of Madea. I think I saw it 37 times. I knew the whole play off by heart. And she was, we became friends. She was a very big influence in my life.
Your beloved Nonna was not too distant geographically from you while you were living in London. Did you get to go and visit her again as a young man?
The war in then Yugoslavia broke out, and I couldn't get into the country. I had a restaurant in Greece at that time as well, and sort of going back and forwards from London into summers, and I lived my kind of best life, and I didn't really know the extent of what was happening in Yugoslavia to how bad it was. I just thought I wasn't able to go in and see her. So years and years went on, and I was never able to kind of have that connection with her. I saw her only once after we left.
So you had this opportunity of living away from your family to really express who you were, find who you were, connect with your community. What about letting your family know about who you were? How did that play out?
That was a really wonderful story. I felt like it was time to share it. I was seeing a gentleman in London who was also quite a big influence on my life and lived the life of, you know, that sort of hidden class that happens in London, and the influences and the lessons and etiquette that I was taught from this little kid from Croatia, then thrown into Western suburbs, and all of a sudden I was playing polo in a totally wrong outfit. But anyway, that's a whole other story.
What did you wear to play polo? Well, and what should have you worn?
Well, I knew it was jodhpurs and boots, you see, and I knew that I could get that, but I didn't. I'm really incriminating myself here. But so I went and spent a lot of my pennies into Jean-Paul Gaultier and bought jodhpurs from Jean-Paul Gaultier and the boots, but not the traditional riding ones. And when I arrived, oh, my goodness, it wasn't received well. And then I got, as a gift, I got a book on etiquette, which I hated. But it was probably the best thing that happened because I learned so much from that book.
It's interesting, Vinko, because I think some people, particularly some Australians, I don't know, we might think of etiquette as, old-fashioned or repressive, or it sounds, though, the way you're describing it, like it gave you a kind of power knowing the codes that were expected.
Absolutely. It was literally life-changing. And I will always have, I think, that heart that my grandmother taught me to have. But the change that happened through London and the influences that I've had through this world that opened up for me, from theatre to different way of life, totally the opposite to that kid from Croatia and the one that had almost had a nervous breakdown growing up in Australia from the age of 13. So, yes, it was definitely power. It was everything that I wanted. And I made some really smart decisions and made some really great money. But I loved London on, you know, £80 a week more than I loved London on £700 a week.
It was while you were living in Europe in the 1990s that you learned about your HIV status. How did you discover that?
That was actually slightly later, Sarah. When I came back to Australia, I was in a relationship with someone. And so I carried being this nurturer and carer into my new relationships, and I always found that person who I could take care of. And one of my partners was, I guess you could call him an addict of from one, and I know the stories, not to share too much about someone's life, from one addiction to another and so forth. And I helped him escape all of that by nurturing and giving love. But the addiction is a strange thing. You continuously have to be addicted to something. And then the sexual addiction started for him. And he was the one that brought HIV into our relationship. And there's something that you always know something is wrong, right? That intuitive feeling. And so when I got the phone call that he needed to talk to me, I knew what the phone call was going to be about. Then again, taken from my end in a very positive light, instead of going down the poor me syndrome of I have HIV, I literally took myself off the disco floor and became very healthy and introduced yoga and meditation and lifestyle into my world and stopped being as social as I was, let's say.
Well, thankfully, medication has made that a completely different diagnosis for people living in places where they can access it. But what about the stigma of that diagnosis? Was that still an issue at the time?
At the time, absolutely. I think there is still stigma. And it's the most complex part of gay dating. And I talk about this a lot in my work and my relationships and in my friendships. We need to open those conversations to remove the stigma. And being vulnerable is the only way to do it. So to share my story and be open with that, if it helps one person in the choices that they make, well, then my job is done with that world. But it's stigma was certainly much higher to what it is now.
I want to ask you about meeting Andrea, who's now your husband. Where did you first see him? What kind of image did he strike?
Oh, Sarah. I would practice. I was in Dubrovnik. We both ended up being in Dubrovnik, and I would practice yoga every morning on the beach, and it was part of the beach where it would turn into a nudist beach after a while. But in Croatia, lots of it's
differently common in Europe than Australia.
Correct. And anyway, when I first landed my eyes on Andrea, he was dancing naked on the rock with no music.
So the dancing bits may be less common than dancing naked bit, or is that a Croatian thing?
Well, I think it's more a gay thing or an Andrea thing. But there was no music. He was just having a great time, and I was in the water having a swim, and I looked at him and I went, "Oh, that's so handsome," and. Anyway, we were both in relationships when we met. There was no boundaries crossed. It was just the image of that kind.
And did you speak to one another at the beach that day?
We did. We spoke, I think, the next day. And then there was a big festival in Dubrovnik where we'd over 10,000 to 20,000 people that show up in a tiny medieval town. There was no way. We didn't exchange numbers. We didn't do anything. There was no way. Of course, I went home and I went, oh, wouldn't have been. The reason why I went into town subconsciously was to bump into him again. But I knew that it was, you couldn't even walk through the city. And the first bar that I went into, as I was ordering the drink, I turned my head to the left. And who was there looking so handsome in his pale blue shirt? I remember it so vividly. And I went, please go away. And he was there with his partner, and I had a partner in Australia. There was no boundaries crossed between us. But that was probably worse than if there were.
Why?
Because we then continued this wonderful communication between the two of us. And in 3 months of me being back in Australia, we had 2,743 emails between us. And I know the number because I photocopied them all to take to immigration when the woman asked, do you have proof of your relationship? Here it is.
He invited you to visit him in Italy at the start, or at this transition from friendship to a different kind of relationship. What was that trip like?
Well, I was going back to Croatia to do some paperwork for my mum with property and so forth. And I was traveling via Italy, and he said he was going to be in Italy for a wedding. And we planned this. I would say we made a decision to have an affair. And as awful as that might sound, it was very clear to me that my relationship I was in was not working for a long time. And it was probably the best relationship, including the current one, that I've ever had. It was calm and it was easy and it was nurturing, it was loving, but it wasn't the right one for me. So I made a decision that I was going to go and see him. And as an Italian Latino man, Andrea put on the show that you could not imagine. It was
what do you mean?
Oh, but it was incredible. We stayed in like medieval castles full of Medici artwork collections and villas and masserias and places. And it was a dream. Like we lived these 10 days. Yeah, absolutely a dream. So it was very hard to go back from that.
So how did you, or did you know that this was going to be more than a holiday romance and affair and something more serious?
I knew straight away when I met Andrea that we both gave each other energy to be able to do anything we possibly want together in life. Whether that was going to be possible to execute or not was another story. But I've never been the person that takes no for an answer. So I'm all in. I just kind of go and I do things wholeheartedly. It was a very difficult time because it meant I had to leave a relationship and close a whole life, a whole wonderful life that I had in Sydney, and basically start again from nothing.
How long did it take for Andrea to move to join you in Australia?
Not long. No, we didn't take long at all. So there was a big risk of doing everything, but it always felt right.
What was communication like between the two of you at the beginning? I mean, you come from different cultures, different languages. What did that mean?
That's a very good question. And that meant a recipe for a divorce every single day. And you really have to learn, and we're still continuously learning about communication and how to navigate it. Because what conversation in certain culture means is very different what it does in our world. Not everybody communicates to listen.
What did Andrea bring to the table when it comes to communication?
Lots of reactiveness and lots of colour. You know, and you talk in a different style. You talk really fast and you get overexcited. But those are all things that I loved about Andrea when I met him. And I loved that he represented this big childlike energy, which is what I asked for. So you've got to be very careful. The universe presents itself when you ask. And then you have to navigate how to nurture that and how to understand it and communicate around that. So that's why listening skills are so important to me.
And for you, what do you think he found challenging about the way you naturally communicate or were raised to communicate?
Shall we leave that to Andrea? No, but I can answer that. He would often say, oh, just be a little bit more flexible. It's okay, you know how I talk. Just be, adapt to it, you know, and that's very much about the Italian, the Latino culture. They're just very vibrant and theatrical. Maybe I, in my groups, I was always seen like that, but compared...
It's all relative.
It's all relative, right?
The Croatian to the Australian, then to the Italian, I see. So you were clearly really serious about one another. You know, he'd moved to join you in Australia. You were building a life together. Had you told him about your HIV status?
Do you know, Sarah, Andrea was the first person that I didn't tell about my HIV status. Everybody in my life knew, and I was so open from the minute that I got it, and I was so acceptant of it in my own world. There was no secret whatsoever.
So what happened here?
I think you have to... sometimes where people come from and the environments that they come from have to be considered in how much you share. I think Andrea had a lack of education on what it means to living with HIV. And it was not an easy decision to make. I spoke to two of my dearest friends in what was the right thing to do. And so many times I had those conversations and so many letters I've wrote about exchanging it to him. But I knew deep down that if I exchanged it at the time when we got together, that there would be no us. So I made a call of not sharing it because I wanted to protect us. And eventually it was going to, of course, come out. It can't not. But then a day became a week became a month became a year became 2 years, and then a year became 5 years. And we basically joined. And we are so intertwined. From the moment we got together, we joined our lives together and created everything. So for those 5 years, I lived in fear that I could so easily, because of my dishonesty, lose everything and be back on square one. But I always believed in the power of love, and I shared it.
How did you raise it when you finally?
I didn't raise it. I just left my medication and my pouch where I was kept in on the bench in the bathroom, and I knew it was going to be seen, and so it.
What was that day like while you were waiting to find out how Andrea had? Was going to take that news.
The initial thing was very much like you've been lied to, of course. I can't believe this is happening to me.
Was he worried about his own health?
I mean, he went straight
away. Was his health at risk?
No, never. well, I don't think he would have known that, right? Because he, I mean, we, by this stage, we've learned so much about HIV and we worked with gay men and their education was there. But of course, the first thing you do is you go and have a test. And so Andrea did go and have tests straight away. And at this stage, I think you could get results automatically. But that evening when we sat together and talked, I instantly, I mean, he was so genuine and so sweet and so supportive and so kind and just went, we are much bigger than this, and told me that if I did tell him in the beginning that there wouldn't be us and all of this, he confirmed what I knew and why I made those decisions in the beginning. Would I do it again? Absolutely not. I don't think it's worth living with that, but if you have to make that decision to sustain the relationship and the love that you have because of lack of education or culture differences, then I think I've made the right decision.
Once you had the burden of that secrecy off your shoulders and Andrea had the whole truth of the situation, how did your relationship change? Did it?
Instantly that evening it changed. It was like somebody just taken this 300 kilos off my back, but not just in weight, but in energy. I felt safe. I automatically just went, well, now it's all there. There's nothing, there is nothing no one can ever do, and we can now live this love. So I think we kind of started living our relationship 5 years in, and now it's 16.
You and Andrea now run an international matchmaking business for gay men together. A matchmaking service sounds almost old-fashioned, Vinko. Like, why is that needed in this modern world of online dating and so many ways for people to be able to connect with one another?
I think you are absolutely right, Sarah. We live in a world we've never been more connected. But it takes me back to that childhood time where there was no internet, of course. There was no applications. There was no phones. But I really felt seen. I felt loved. I felt heard. And in today's world, I think that's what's lacking. We are so connected but so missing all of those things. And that's what I learn every day more and more about the importance of my job in today, in our community particularly, because it's communication and listening skills have just disappeared. Instant results are expected from relationships. No one wants to do the hard work. And we are the only business that look after that kind of monogamy long-term, that provides this safe haven for people to create love. It's a lovely job to have in people's lives. Mm. I've always loved relationships with monogamy and long-term and commitment. Also, I spend a lot of time with each person, so you need to feel connected to people's lives and stories. So that's the umbrella we've covered. So yes, it is very old-fashioned, but it's been around for centuries. It works.
You know, I have gay friends, Vinko, who say they don't really want to have a relationship, say, like my marriage, that this monogamous, committed relationship is maybe a kind of a heterosexual construction they don't want to be forced into. What do you make of that idea?
Oh, my. I support it 100%. I think we all live our lives in how we want to live them. And if that's a safe haven for someone, well, amazing. So live it in that sense. I mean, there are so many people that look at my business and my model and go, oh, those silly boys, monogamy, long-term, who wants that? And it's okay. But I love to be able to offer that for somebody who does want it, because I think it's so much harder to find. Mm. And monogamy, I think, means a very different thing.
In the gay community, it might have a different definition.
I think heterosexual dating is becoming very similar to what gay dating used to be like. And I hear stories all the time on that. So I just think that the gays talk about it and they open, and the heterosexuals swipe it under the carpet and don't think that it's really happening in their world. But for me, if you have a relationship where you have good communication with your partner and you find yourself in a Mallorca together and you have this wonderful monogamous relationship and there's somebody, this handsome European man that wants to nibble on both of you, it might make even your relationship even stronger. But as long as you have communication around it and you feel safe and secure, I still think that's monogamy. But living open relationships, personally, for me, that's a slippery slope towards disaster.
After you introduce a couple, do you get to hear how those introductions play out?
I love it when that happens. Not always it's taken in that way, but the more I know, the more I'm engaged, the more I hear from people's stories, the more I learn if that introduction hasn't worked out, how the next one, what I need to do towards the next one that will be okay.
What's the key for you? I mean, are you trying to match people with similar interests or life, or is it, do you sometimes try to think this is what this person thinks they want, but really I can see beneath that to something else?
There's a little bit of both in play, but I spend a lot of time with each client, and the key thing for me, if I can see people on a Saturday morning in comfortable silences with their slippers and a pair of tracksuit pants on, and not the pink ones.
I was going to say, you've got look at how you've fallen.
No, the cashmere ones these days. Very different tracksuits we're talking about here, but they've stuck, haven't they? So if I can see two people with similar, and in all seriousness, When people have had similar constitutional formative years, you know, up to the age of 15, doesn't matter who we are today, I think when that's similar, we are going to work as a couple. Doesn't matter what we do for work. But I think money and finances and emotions and everything else plays also a big part. When you can plan similar holidays or go out for similar dinners, when you're combining lives together at 30 or 40 or 50 years of age, you want somebody someone is always going to earn more money than the other person. But when you can bring all of those things, and then once I get that right and I feel that that's there, the first box that I go to is physical and sexual attractions.
And that's going on what they've told you?
Yes, I have a whole visual presentation of life of my clients through their friends and their family and their homes and their holidays. And it's a wonderful, wonderful part of the journey with my clients of that. And people really let you into their world and then into their attractions and their previous partners. And
it's a very vulnerable position people are putting themselves in with you.
It's the most important job that anyone gives me in their lives. And I am not the person, what I've learned through my journeys, if you can hear it, that mediocrity is not very good with me. I don't like it in any sense of the way, but I particularly don't like it when it comes to relationships because I've lived a bad one. And it still stays in my world and has residue of that negativity. So I don't want anybody else to have to live that.
What are some of the stories that have really stayed with you, of love stories that you've helped be a part of? Are there particular clients or stories that stay with you?
Oh, of course. I mean, I love family. So when families happen, and in today's world, I mean, look how far we've come. We talk about this still having stigmas on our community and our lives, but we can have kids. We can create a relationship. We are equally treated. We're living a pretty fragile world at the moment, and hopefully that all sustains and continues to be kept to where it is. But that's the stories that I love. I love the ones of family. I love them. And I like the story of somebody that I meet and I love them and I know that I can help them. And I know that out there it would be really difficult for them to find someone, and it happens on the first introduction with us. And you almost didn't take them on board because you thought that would be more difficult than somebody else. And then you have the one that you thought it was going to go on the first introduction and they're still there 18 months later. It's not all roses.
What about your own relationship, Vinko? What's daily life like for you and Andrea now? You're still dancing naked on rocks?
Yes, we are.
Good.
Yes, we are. We keep the joy. We really keep the joy. But Sarah, our relationship is super complex as well, because we are very different people, but almost the same person. So we continuously have to work on being the best to each other. But we really have figured out what that communication looks like for us. And we have hard times, like every relationship does. But I think people leave their relationships way too early these days, and the grass is always greener on the other side. And what we've learned and what we've given each other is the promise that we will always work through it, and it can only happen through communication.
What about that beautiful home of your grandmother's in Croatia where you spent so much time as a child? How is it part of your life now?
Well, it's ours. It was one of the first and one of the things that Andrea and I have done together, and still till today, the best decision we did. The house went in inheritance to my auntie, and she was selling, and it was going to go to a Russian, because the Russians were buying a lot of Croatia at the time. And I just couldn't have that home change the dynamic that it had through my childhood. And I know even before my existence, my grandparents entertained there. It just, the home got exactly what it always had, with Andrea and I taking it over, and it's now in renovation, and it's provided such a wonderful, wonderful joy for so many of our friends and our family, because Andrea is from Bari, across the road from Dubrovnik. We have this joke, we used to wave to each other as kids across the Adriatic, so the Italians come into the house, and, you know.
Do you sense your grandma there? How do you think she...
Oh, she's there. And I mean, she's there. She's. I know this might sound strange, but not just to us, but she's shown herself and her presence. If anyone believes that that's possible, I'm still question it, but there's been signs of...
Well, everyone better dress properly for dinner and behave themselves,
correct.
I would think.
We still have her napery. She'll be happy with that.
Vinko, it's been such a delight to meet you. Thank you so much for being my guest on Conversations.
Sarah, thank you so much. It's so, so very kind of you to have me. And I'm so happy, really happy to be here with you today. Thank you so much.
Vinko Anthony's book is called All In, How to Make Love Stick. This conversation was produced by Maggie Morris and recorded on the lands of the Turrbal and Yagara peoples. Our executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations episodes, head to ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.